I am Kathy Beecham, and I've been coming to Crossroads. My husband Pete and I joined probably a little over 10 years now. We were still in the school at Clark Montessori, and then we moved into this building, and we did Crazy Campaign. We did Game Change. We volunteered at the Info Center. Gosh, any Info Center people here? For years. Yay, Info Center. And I'm actually still in the small group that I joined 6 years ago, I guess, on our very first all-church journey. We still call ourselves lifers. That's how old we are. But actually, Pete and I were not church people. Not at all. Before we got to Crossroads, we had not been in a church community for probably 30 years. I hadn't given up on God, but I had given up on the church where I was raised. He didn't even know God well enough to give up on him. God just wasn't a factor in Pete's life at all. So that's how we were when we came to Crossroads. Now, this series, I just love it. I love the lights, the circle lights, the circus music, all that stuff. And what we're focusing our attention on, Jesus, the greatest show on earth, is we're focusing our attention on how he drew crowds, how they flocked to him. Just like Rockstar. If you were here for the first series, you remember Stephen Manuel. He mentions Jesus, Lady Gaga, the Beatles, and Steve Martin. All in the same sentence. Is that not a Crossroads thing to do? That's just perfect kind of thing. Well, they flocked to Jesus. He drew big crowds because of his teaching. But he also drew crowds because he healed people. That's the topic today. It's Jesus as the healer. Now, this topic meant a lot to me and means a lot to me. Not too long ago, my husband, Pete Natterney, he hated it if anybody called him Beecham. It was Pete Natterney. He got diagnosed with a brain tumor. He actually found it himself. He had symptoms that weren't real severe, and he would go to the doctors, and they just kind of dismiss it and say, you're just getting old, don't worry about it. But Pete knew something was wrong. So as Pete would do, he got impatient with the medical community, and he went to one of those, full body scan shops, where you can buy your own scan. That's what he did. I think he went to ProScan or something. And he paid for it with his credit card. And he got a scan. And he was right. There was something wrong. His whole body was clean, but they found a mass in his left temporal lobe in his brain, right above his ear. And it was bad. It was a brain tumor. It was the worst kind of brain tumor you could have. In medical speak, it was called a grade 4 glioblastoma multiforme. The docs called it GBM. And there is no cure. They also don't know what causes brain tumors, but there was no cure for this. So his prognosis was really bad. 6 months. Some docs gave him 11. I remember at one point the doc said to Pete, if you didn't have bad luck, you wouldn't have any luck at all, fella. He said, the injury in your brain is probably the largest and the most aggressive that I have ever seen in my career to date. There is not a happy ending to this story. There isn't. I wish I had that story to tell. I really do. I wish I could say Pete was healed and that he's here today and we're happily together, but that is not my story to tell, actually. Pete died 25 months after he was diagnosed. He died in 2008, and I'm a widow now. Now, you're probably wondering why I would be the one talking about Jesus as the healer. Well, Jesus did show up. He showed up in Pete, and he showed up in me. It was just not the healing that we had hoped for or wanted or actually expected, but but he did heal. Now, I promise you before the end of this message, you're going to actually hear from a colleague of Pete and mine. Her name's Lynn, and she and Richard actually worked the info center with us for years. And she actually got a death sentence similar to Pete's, a different kind of disease, but very serious and very significant. And her outcome is a little different. And it's important to get both messages. But let's first look at the miracle stories of Jesus. And there in every account of Jesus' life, I mean every one, I mean whether you're talking Matthew or Mark or Luke or John, every one of them has these stories in them. And I remember as a child thinking, God, I love this part of the Bible. It was like, you know, these stories were so comforting. It was like Jesus is Santa Claus, but just bigger, better. And if something would happen to me, I didn't have to worry. Somehow Jesus would fix it. As I matured, and I'm not in any faith community now, I still read the Bible every so often, but I basically kind of inside, I just kind of discounted all the stuff that I just thought was not possible to believe. And I didn't really check that assumption with anybody. I just kind of figured that any well-educated, intelligent person probably discounted, just like I did, the scriptures. So when I got to Crossroads, and here were these guys who were fairly smart, telling me that the Bible is true, all of it, and that this is God's story, embrace it, believe it, I was challenged. So I thought, well, here's what I'll do. I'll get into the scripture myself, and I'll just see if I can still get God's message, still experience what he's trying to tell me, but just kind of separate out all the stuff, you know, that seemed a little crazy, like all these miracle things. So I did. And I actually started with Mark, because Mark, that's the shortest gospel. So I started with the shortest one. And here's what I found out. Chapter 1, Jesus drives out evil spirits in a man. Then he heals Peter's mother-in-law. Then the crowds around Peter's house are so huge, and he accommodates them. He goes out, and he heals all of these people that are waiting. And then he heals a man with leprosy, which was the worst disease ever in Jesus' time. And that's in chapter 1. In 2, you get the story of the paralytic. Remember the one, the guy on the stretcher, the four friends. They had lots of faith. They couldn't get in to see Jesus. They go up on a roof, tear off all the dirt, drop Jesus down so he could be healed. That's in chapter 2. Now, chapter 3 in Mark, what Mark says is that the crowds are so pressing on Jesus. I mean, they are just like crushing him, trying to touch him to get healed. They're just coming at him, and he has to go in a boat to get some distance from the crowds in order to be able to teach. Now, in chapter 4 of Mark, there are no healing miracles. You can check it out. There aren't any. He just calms a storm in that chapter. Chapter 5, he's back at it, though. He drives out another demon from another possessed man. He heals a sick woman, and he brings a dead girl back to life. Well, I gave up. I realized that my strategy of separating out all the crazy stuff just wasn't going to work. That Jesus is teaching his message, what he did, it was all tangled together. And so over the years, I actually opened my heart, and Pete's heart was open too. And we actually, here at Crossroads, I mean, we got introduced to a God that was a whole lot better than we ever imagined. And we developed a relationship with that God that, like many of you who've been here for lots of years, I mean, it changed our lives forever. I mean, he changed everything. And I've always been thankful to this place, to Crossroads, for being the place where God got introduced to me and I was able to develop a relationship with him. Now, there is something curious in these miracle stories. Matthew, Mark, Luke, those three guys, they all talk about them as miracles. But John, the fourth guy who gives us an account of Jesus' life, he doesn't. He uses the word sign. You can see it right here. He says, and a great crowd of people followed him because of the signs he performed by healing the sick. Why did John use the word signs? I thought, what's he trying to tell us? You know, signs, think about signs, traffic signs, you know, a curve's coming, intersection, exit 141, it's yours. I mean, they don't really have any value in themselves. It's really what they point to that's important. So, what are Jesus' miracles pointing to? And the obvious one would be how I saw the miracles as a kid, right? I mean, Jesus is God. He can do divine things. Maybe Jesus was kind of showing that off. He could take a crippled man, make him walk, blind people see, mute people speak. Clearly, all that true. But then maybe what John was suggesting is that the miracles were a sign of what God's heart was like, what his Father's heart was like, what his heart was like, that he was just full of compassion, and that when someone was ill or someone was suffering, he just wanted to respond to them, meet their need, heal them. And that's true too. Now, what we do know about Jesus and all the miracle stories, we know this. We know he did not ignore illness. If any of you are suffering right now or ill right now, you can be sure of one thing. Jesus isn't avoiding you. He didn't run away. He is very close to you. He is closer to people who are suffering than to anybody else. That's why everyone wanted to touch him. He got very close. So we know that. The second thing we know about from Jesus' miracle stories is we know he identified the source of illness, disease, and even death. And Luke actually gives us this account. Look at this. He says, on Sabbath, Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues, and a woman was there who had been crippled by a spirit for 18 years. She was bent over, could not straighten up at all. When Jesus saw her, he called her forward, and he said, woman, you are set free from your infirmity. And then he put his hands on her, and immediately she straightened up and praised God. Indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, the synagogue ruler, he says to the people, there's 6 days for work, so come and be healed on those days. Don't come on the Sabbath. And Jesus said, oh, you hypocrites, don't each of you on the Sabbath untie your donkey from the stall and lead it for water? Then should not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, meaning one of the family here, whom Satan has kept bound for 18 long years, be set free on the Sabbath day from what bound her? He identifies the source. Jesus quickly says, the source of illness, disease, and death, it's Satan, it's evil, it's part of the kingdom of darkness. It is not part of my world. Now, I got to know Greg Boyd here at Crossroads like you did, got introduced to him. He's a well-known theologian. When Pete was diagnosed, and I'm struggling with how to deal and accept this presence of very clear presence of evil in our lives and suffering that was going to come from it, the book Boyd wrote called Is God to Blame really helped me work through that whole issue of evil. He, in that book, actually comments on the scripture. Let's see what he has to say. He says, Jesus didn't offer the counsel that many believers today offer. He didn't suggest that this woman's affliction was somehow part of his Father's secret plan. He didn't encourage her to accept her affliction as coming from a father's hand. Neither did he encourage her to believe that the Father was hiding a smile behind the frowning providence of her deformity. No, to the contrary. I mean, Jesus taught his audience that this infirmity was the work of Satan, who was resisting God's will. And he then demonstrated the Father's will by opposing Satan and miraculously healing this person. If you're suffering, I'm close to you. The source of your illness and disease is not me. It comes from the kingdom of darkness. It's from Satan. It's evil. And I will set you free. That's Jesus' message. I will set you free. I will set you free. Trust me. No matter what your circumstances are, trust me. Trust me, and you will be set free in a way that you probably didn't expect. I will heal, I will restore. With all my power, you will experience that healing. That's what Jesus is telling us, and that's why the healing miracles are important. That's the so what. The so what is when suffering, you encounter suffering in your life, when we encounter disease, illness, death, He's telling us, this is how I want you to respond. Now, Pete and I, we were married almost 20 years when he got his diagnosis. We were best of friends. I mean, really good friends. He owned his own business. He was a CEO of his business. I was an executive with the bank. We had busy lives. Both sons, they were grown and gone. One was in Key West. One was in D.C. But boy, when we had time together, we had a great time. I mean, we did everything together. We did groceries together. We ran errands together. I don't think there was ever a vacation that either of us went on without the other person. I mean, we loved being each other's company. And from a business perspective, we actually coached each other because we both had business backgrounds that we respected. And so it was a great bond. I can remember the night that Pete thought he had a brain tumor when he found that out. It was December 20th, 2005. You know, some dates stay forever in your memory. And I was coming in from somewhere, I don't know, it was probably 7:30-ish at night. Pete was sitting in his very favorite chair reading the newspaper like he always did. And I sat down, and I did, thank goodness, remember that he did get a scan that day, and I just kind of casually asked him, I said, what'd you find out? Well, he looks at me, and tears start welling up in his eyes. Got my attention. So I look at him. He said, they wouldn't let me leave after the test. I knew then something was probably wrong. They had me wait, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited. It seemed like forever. And he said, then finally the radiology techs, they came out, and they said, you know, your whole body's clean. There's no evidence of any problems except we saw a mass. It looks like in the left temporal lobe of your brain, right above the ear. And it could be a brain tumor. It's pretty good size, and you need to get to a doctor fast. I remember I was sitting in the chair next to him, and I mean, tears, burning tears came to my eyes, and I just came over to the chair. He's sitting right there, and I just knelt down, and I put my arms around him, and I put my head on his chest, and I said, oh, wow, this changes everything. And I mean, it did. I stopped working, he stopped working, and we started an adventure and a journey that, oh my gosh, had lots of challenges for Pete. He had two brain surgeries. The first surgery was to get the tumor out, and it was successful, 99%. He got 99% of it out. Second surgery was to actually get Pete the benefit of a clinical trial. There's no cure for brain tumors. That's the problem. It's an awful disease. There's no cure. So there's a lot of experimental treatment, so he had a second surgery to get the benefit of that. Took a big toll on his body. He ended up in ICU. He almost died of pneumonia, but oh my gosh, he miraculously recovered. And then the real challenge with brain tumors is they come back. It's not the surgery. It's that they come back. So he had to have MRIs every 30 days. He had radiation for 6 weeks. Toward the end, he had chemo. He had months of physical, occupational, speech therapy because where the tumor was located was near a speech center. So he could understand everything anybody told him. He was a smart guy. I mean, he's a very smart guy. But he couldn't always find the right word. You know, he couldn't find the right word to express his thoughts or his feelings. So we used to always laugh about Pete-isms because he would kind of get the word. Like if his eyes would be teary, he would say, my eyes are frosted. We also got good at charades. So in the midst of all these physical challenges, right, this is how God shows up. God sets Pete free. I mean, he doesn't pay any attention to the fact. He didn't even use the word illness when he talked about himself. He set him free, and he starts working on his list. This guy was a planner. I mean, what would you do? If you're a planner, you make lists, right? So he made lists. The first thing on his list is he wanted to get his driver's license back. He'd had a seizure after the first surgery, and he really likes cars. He really likes to drive. So by August, he got his driver's license back, and we did two trips to Florida, one to Hilton Head, one to Washington, D.C., one to Chicago. I was in the passenger seat. He was very proud of himself. Then he decides all three bathrooms in the house need to get remodeled because that's been on his list for a lot of years, and now he's got to do it because he wants to make sure the house is okay for me. He also gets a new roof put on. That was on his list too. But it was the trips. that absolutely drove Pete. All these places he wanted to go. He had been begging me to go to Mount Rushmore for years, South Dakota, Mount Rushmore. Not high on my list, right? Well, we made it to Mount Rushmore. We did, and I think Pete was fairly impressed by the carvings. I mean, they're impressive, any of you that have seen them. But I'll tell you what he loved. We stayed in Custer State Park, and if you've ever been to Custer State Park, there are 1,500 buffalo in that park. We spent the days chasing buffalo around in the car. I mean, he loved it. We saw wild elk, we saw wild turkeys, and we saw white-tailed deer. He loved animals. He also loved to fish, and he loved salmon. So right after that, we went to Oregon. My brother invited us out to go salmon fishing. We did. Don't ask me if we caught any salmon, all right? But he did love fishing. So when we got back, one of our life group buddies, Matt, he has a boat. He's an avid fisherman. So, I mean, there was Pete, 6:30 in the morning, meeting Matt down at the Ohio River to go fishing. And look. Oh, my gosh. Pete caught a 35-pound catfish in the Ohio River. And you would think, I mean, he was like the local fishing champion. He was so excited about it. Pete also loved cars. And he was really excited when he could take, my sister's actually here, and so's Mike, my brother-in-law, and he got to take them to his very favorite race. I went to the 24 Hours of Daytona in Florida in January, end of January. Always the same weekend. Awesome. It's sports cars now, not NASCAR, not Indies, but he loves sports cars. From there, we went to Sebring, the 12 Hours of Sebring in Sebring, Florida. And then, oh, a dream. Pete had always bought Speed Channel as part of our cable service. And, you know, he didn't really watch it that much. I mean, he wasn't really a NASCAR fan, and Indy cars, they were okay, but, I mean, what he really loved was sports cars. Well, here's the reason he bought Speed Channel. Every June, the best, biggest, oldest sports car race in the world happens. In Le Mans, the 24-hour sports car race in Le Mans, France. And he's going, I've always wanted to go. Well, my sister, who's sitting right there, she said, you are crazy. You're going to take a brain tumor patient to France? Why not? And so we did. Here we are. There's Pete, Michael, his son Michael, and son Steve sitting around him in Le Mans. We were part of a race team. This was our shirt, Barze Epsilon. Golf, racing. It was awesome experience. But actually, I think the thing he loved more than that, even Le Mans race, is that we took a little side trip to Normandy, and he was a World War II buff. I mean, he loved history. And oh my gosh, when we got to walk at Omaha Beach and Utah Beach and see where all those American soldiers were killed and go to the American cemetery, I mean, he was so touched. Well, we got back from France, and he was fine. And then we thought, what else is on the list? We went to Glacier Park in Montana. We went to the Tetons in Wyoming, and we went to Yellowstone. And, I mean, here is a guy with a brain tumor, right? And the park ranger is screaming at him for getting too close to the black bears. Now, in addition to Pete being set free by God of ever being worried about his illness, I mean, his 30-day MRIs, they were kind of inconvenienced. He just tried to schedule around. But he changed in other ways, too. I saw God's presence in Pete. And this guy was a really good businessman. I mean, everything I learn about negotiation, I basically learn about Pete. And anybody who's a good negotiator, you know you don't let your emotions on your sleeve. That doesn't make you a good negotiator. So he was a fairly private person. He didn't really express his feelings that much. And all of a sudden, he becomes very transparent emotionally. I mean, he always had a sense of humor, but all of a sudden, he is laughing all the time. I mean, he and my brother-in-law, Mike, I mean, they got to be like brothers during this journey. And I mean, they are yucking it up all the time. And Mike's here today. That's what I could point to. I mean, they're laughing like crazy, just about anything stupid stuff. I mean, he liked Brian's jokes during this period. I mean, you know, it was just like, wow, this is great. So he laughed. He also cried. I mean, here's a man who I had seen cry once in 20 years, once. And he was so easily touched now by any kindness. I mean, a card, a visit, a letter, and his eyes would tear up. I mean, my family threw a birthday party for him, and they built this collage, you know, and they framed it, and they put all of his sayings and all of his very favorite things and pictures of him and me and on the collage. And I mean, there's Pete and my family, when we're together, it's over 30 people. And there, with all these people, there's Pete looking at this. Tears are streaming down his face. He is so touched. We were in D.C. with Stephen, our son, and Pete would have to walk. The docs wanted him to walk as part of his therapy. And so we were walking around the neighborhood, and Stephen and Kathy came with us. And on the way home, I remember Pete saying to me, with tears in his eyes, he says, you know, Stephen hates to exercise. He never walks. I have never walked with him. He's my son, and he has never walked with me. He did that for me, he would say. I saw no fear in Pete, ever, not even to the very last moment of his life. I did not see fear. He had a peace about him. He didn't have much anxiety. I mean, I had lots of anxiety. I had a ton of anxiety. Like, oh my gosh, what do you think the doctor's going to say today when we visit with him? What do you think the MRI is going to show? Blah, 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 blah. And he would just kind of look at me and calmly look at me. And this is what he would always say. This was his response to my anxiety. He would say, well, we'll just have to see what the Lord's plan is. End of discussion. No more. We get up in the morning and we would pray before breakfast. And this is his prayer. Almost every day, this would be his prayer. He'd say, thanks, God, for letting me wake up. I have this day, and I thank you. And then he'd look at me, and he'd say, and I get to spend it with you. Now, God just didn't do things in Pete. He also did a lot of nice things for Pete. I mean, he came present to him in a way that we were always amazed. We used to laugh, those of us who traveled with him. I mean, all those trips I just talked about, and there's more that I didn't even mention. All those trips, it never rained. Not once. Didn't rain. I mean, the planes were always on time. When's the last time that happened? I mean, they were. We never got delayed. And we used to always kind of worry because walking at times was challenging for Pete, so we'd always worry about, gosh, could we get him closest to the, you know, door when we were trying to go to a restaurant or museum or store or whatever, and wouldn't you know, we'd drive up and boom, there'd be a parking space right there in front of the door every time. We get into any restaurant we wanted, and we're always seated by the window because we were with Pete, of course. But here's the best story about what God did for Pete. And it happened the day of his first brain tumor surgery. We're at the Cleveland Clinic. We're in pre-op. And pre-op is this big room, cold, big room. Nurse's station is in the center. And then all the folks waiting for surgery, all the patients waiting for surgery, they're on stretchers, kind of like spokes around this nurse's station. And they give you a cubicle, like a shower rod's around your stretcher, and you have like curtains, white curtains. You got the picture? So that's where Pete is. He's on the stretcher in a hospital gown, markings on his head for the surgery. All of us, the family, we're together with him, standing around the stretcher, and we're praying. Well, Pete had started doing something very unusual, for Pete, that is. He started writing notes to God, his conversations with God before he died. They really weren't writings. I mean, it was more like a business guy does, you know, like bullet points, you know. He'd like do bullet points for God. And this is a section of one of his notes. You can see he likes me a lot. That's me, Kathy, up there. Loving, perfect as always, right? They said I was humble, yeah. But no, this is the day before surgery now. This is the day before surgery. And he says, I'm counting down. And he says, God, I'm in your hands. I will take one, just one big angel, though. And so sure enough, we're at the clinic. We're praying around Pete, and we're praying hard. We're saying, Michael the Archangel, show up. Pete needs you, the warrior angel. Come do battle for him. And all of a sudden, this big guy, I mean this big guy, big, I mean really big, he opens the curtain, sticks his head out, and goes, I'm Chris, hi. We're like, who are you? You know, like, he goes, I'm actually taking Pete into surgery, but I was standing outside the curtains here, and I heard you guys praying, and do you mind if I join you? So in walks Chris, we hold hands, we pray. And then he says to Pete, he says, okay, buddy, it's time to go. He gets behind Pete's stretcher, starts pushing Pete out, and, you know, there's this long haul down to the operating room, and we're all, you know, we can't go with him, so we're standing there. Hard moment. And as Chris pushes that stretcher there, he looks over his shoulder back at us, and he says, I'm praying him right through this. Don't worry about it. And I thought, wow, God's big angel. He showed up. He stayed with Pete right through the surgery. Now, I always used to tell Pete that as much as God was giving him more days and showing up for him physically, he was also healing me as a caregiver. And my healing was probably, I should say, my healing is just about as miraculous as yours, buddy, let me tell you. I mean, from that very first day when I said to Pete, this changes everything, I walked away from my career, I quit work. I mean, it was like, oh my gosh, I even surprised myself. I said, this is not my doing here. This is God in me. I'm having an experience of God right now. It was the easiest decision I'd ever made in my life after 25 years of working. And it became very clear to me that if I submitted myself to Pete and made him the sole focus of my attention, that I was obeying God and actually fulfilling part of my purpose in life. And I'll tell you, the freedom that I felt and the joy that I felt in making that decision, it was exhilarating. It was exhilarating. He healed me in other ways too. This one I'm not very proud of. So other than those of you in this room, don't tell other people, please. I'm kind of ashamed of this, actually. We're sitting in a brain tumor support group at the wellness community in Blue Ash, early in Pete's journey. There's other brain tumor patients there, other caregivers there, right? Listening to their stories, what's going on with them. And, you know, what I should have been feeling at that moment, right, is tremendous compassion, respect, appreciation for their struggle, amazed at the generosity of the caregivers there. And I wasn't. I kind of was, but I kind of wasn't. I mean, I'm sitting there secretly ranking and evaluating each of the brain tumor patients to see if Pete was the best of the brain tumor patients and whether I was the best of the caregivers. I mean, duh. I mean, these people are dying, and I'm sitting there ranking them. I mean, talk about performance comparison habits that the corporation creates in us. Those habits die very, very hard. Ouch, ouch, ouch. I had to slow down with Pete. Sometimes people felt sorry for him because now he was the sole object of all my energy, you know. I learned how to listen, not just to Pete, but I started listening more to everybody. Not just pretending to listen, but really listen, appreciating their stories. I learned patience. We would walk and we would count every step, one, two. We'd get to 800, we would celebrate. 800 steps today, Pete. But I learned how the light's different at 10 in the morning or 3 in the afternoon, and I can tell you now how the shadows play. And in that slowing down, God transformed me. And the other huge thing he healed me from was fear. For any of you who are a caregiver, you know what that's like. especially if you're a caregiver through any kind of major disease, cancer for sure. I mean, you know how it is. It's a constant roller coaster. There's, you know, a little teeny piece of good news, more bad news, bad news. And it goes on and on. And I mean, there was a zillion of those things with Pete. It was awful. I mean, Pete, he's not eating. Why isn't he eating? Should we do a feeding tube? Should we not do a feeding tube? Oh, the thought of that, I just didn't even want to think about. Why is the blood pressure spiking? What's happening with his blood sugar? You know, would he pass the swallowing test? I mean, everything, constant, on and on and on, and every one of those things terrified me. I mean, I'm working in a medical world that I had never been in, and when I was afraid like that, I actually was a pretty bad caregiver. I mean, I was awful. I mean, I remember at one point Pete even said, you know what, you're mean. And I'm trying to love him, and that's when I got afraid, I would try to exert pressure. I would try to exert pressure, and I would try to control, and you probably know enough about Pete to know he does not like any control. And it was an uncontrollable situation, and I'm trying to control it. And I mean, we used to fight, for God's sake, over whether he took his medicine or not. So God healed me from that. And I'm a reader, so the way God healed me actually was through a book, and it's through this book, Max Lucado's book called Traveling Light. And I want to read just a section of how the story that healed me. And it's in chapter 6, actually, on hopelessness. It's on hopelessness. And Max tells us in this book, he says, imagine yourselves in a jungle, lost and alone. Well, I could imagine that. I could imagine being in a jungle because I had gotten lost once. It was in my late teens. I was in the Daniel Boone National Forest in Kentucky. I was hiking with friends, and somehow I got separated from them. And my friends, I couldn't see them. I didn't know where they were, and I just kept walking thinking I'd find them, and I didn't. And all of a sudden, I realized I had no sense where they were. I had no sense where I was. I totally lost my sense of direction. It was before cell phones, so there's no way I could get a hold of them. I'm in T-shirt and shorts, no food, no water. It starts getting dark. I mean, I am terrified. So when Max said to me, imagine being lost and alone in a jungle, I could. Now he says in the book, he says, just as vividly imagine getting rescued. What would that be like? What would you want? You want a person, obviously, right? But not just an equally confused and lost person, but rather a person who knew the way out. And from this person, you needed encouragement. You wanted to hear, we'll get you out. But not just encouragement, you wanted direction. You wanted them to be able to say, I know how to get you out. Now, if you only had a person, but no renewed vision, all you would have is company. And if this person had a vision, but no direction, you'd have a dreamer for company. But if you had a person with direction who could take you from this place, then you have somebody who could rescue you and give you hope. Now note, the jungle is still there. You have not left. The trees still eclipse the sky and the thorns still cut your skin. Animals lurk, rodents scurry. The jungle's still the jungle. It hasn't changed, but you have. The guide before you, he has a machete. He's hacking away the tall weeds and the underbrush. You, the traveler, by now you're tired, you're hot, you're frustrated, and you say to him, where are we? Do you know where you are taking me? Where is the path? And this experienced guide, he turns around, he looks right at you, and he says, I'm the path. I'm the path. So whenever I would get afraid with Pete, I would just say, remind myself, God, you're the path. If I keep my eyes fixed on you, if I keep my eyes fixed on you, if I follow you, I know you won't leave us. I know you're as close to Pete as anybody would be. You're close to me. I don't need to be afraid. I can trust you. And the fear would disappear. And then I would feel this overwhelming love for Pete. And I'll tell you, the intimate moments that we shared in that 25 months, oh my gosh. I mean, they were sweet. They were tender. They were so wonderful. I mean, some of the most intimate moments that we ever had in our whole married life happened in that journey. In fact, I used to tell him how beautiful he was. I know you're not supposed to tell guys they're beautiful, but I'd wake up in the morning. We'd be doing the morning routines, and by then, I was having to do a lot of the physical kind of living tasks for Pete, and I would just look at him. I'd say, you are so beautiful to me. Even as he's declining physically, he's lost his hair from chemo. He's gotten really heavy from the steroids. I mean, this is not a beautiful guy, and he just, without effort, he just was beautiful to me. And I thought, wow, maybe this is how God sees us. Maybe this is how God sees us. So I learned surrender through Pete. My prayers changed. My grip got a lot lighter. I didn't hold on so hard. And I figured out that the real miracle here, the healing miracle here, was in Pete. It was in me. It was between us. And our job was just to advertise that. Advertise that kingdom. That's the sign that John meant. That's what the miracles were pointing to. God's redemption, his glory was being shown in our midst. That brain tumor did not conquer Pete in his spirit. And that's the sign John meant. He tells us in Revelations, he says this. He says, he will wipe away every tear from our eyes, and there will be no more death, and there will be no more sadness, and there will be no more crying or pain because all the old ways are gone. Pete's last note to me, his last words were, we're going to see each other again, and we will. And that will be a grand day, let me tell you. Now, I promised you another story, similar to Pete's, but with a different outcome. And it's important to be encouraged by this because God wants us to ask him for healing. If you're ill, if you're suffering, if someone close to you is, ask him for healing. That's his message. I have power. Ask for healing. So listen to Lynn's story.
This particular story began in early August of 2008. When I was diagnosed with a very rare and aggressive form of uterine cancer, a prayer session had been put together, and it consisted of family, close friends, and some staff at Crossroads. I think that's when the miracle began. I remember the laying on of hands. I remember the anointing of oil. I do not remember exactly the words that were said. But I remember the incredible heat in the room and the feeling that the Holy Spirit was there throughout this hour of prayer. So I went into surgery the next day with a calmness that I would never have felt knowing I was facing this rare and aggressive cancer. The surgery went well. I had a radical hysterectomy done by the Da Vinci robotic method. There was no apparent sign of any more cancer, so that was good news after the three-hour surgery. 5 days later, I met with my surgeon, Dr. Marcia Bowling, and we had good news and no news. The good news was that the lymph nodes were clear, and the solution they had washed the body with had no malignant cells. However, not one pathology department here in the city of Cincinnati could identify the tumor's profile. It was MD Anderson in Houston that finally identified exactly the type of cancer I had, and that name is undifferentiated endometrial sarcoma. It seems I'm the 31st person in the world on record with this cancer. There have been no positive outcomes for any of the other women, so essentially I was the only person with this cancer. The doctors at MD Anderson were rather negative, don't even bother with treatment. This tumor will be back in 3 to 6 weeks, 12 at the max. I didn't feel that way. I felt I had a chance. I felt they'd caught it early. I felt there had been good news, and I felt that with that prayer session and the Lord holding my hand, he is the great physician. They are not. I asked, will you follow my treatment here? He said, there's absolutely no need to. I know the outcome. I'll tell you, with doctors like that, you really need a deep faith. You really need a faith in the Lord when a doctor speaks to you like that. I decided to do my treatment here in town with the doctors that I trusted and cared about. And it was a very harsh treatment, very harsh chemo, radiation, and then followed by high-dose internal radiation. But I was willing to do whatever it took to be able to look at my family and say, I've done what I can. This August, it will be 3 years. After being promised that the tumor would be back in 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 12 at the max. My last appointment with my surgeon, I said to her, do you believe in miracles? And she looked at me for a long time. She looked deeply into my eyes. And she said, not until you. And perhaps this is what Jesus wants me to be a witness to his power. I'm just so grateful for the deep faith that I have in the Lord, in his will. Now, I did not know if this was going to be his will. I wasn't sure this was his will at all. I just knew he would hold my hand and I would not be alone.
Hey, Corlin. Three years, wow. You know, we'll never know why Lynn has a bad disease and she has a physical outcome that obviously includes physical healing, and why Pete didn't have that same outcome, and we'll never know that. And I'm still in the healing process in terms of my own journey, because I mean, grief is hard. It's really hard. It's difficult. It's clearly the hardest thing I've ever been through in my life. And I have two action things for you, action items as we end our time together today. One is, if there's anybody like you that's out there that has lost somebody they love too, we do have a group here that will walk that journey with you. And I found, I mean, I helped start this group here at Crossroads, actually, because being in community helps healing. And it has helped me heal, and it's going to continue to help me heal. So you can do an early sign-up. We'll start that again in the fall. cg@crossroads.net. You can do an early sign-up for grief. Here's the second action item. Second action item is, if any of you are ill now, or anyone in your family is ill, Jesus doesn't ignore us. His miracles clearly tell us that. He does not ignore suffering. He is very close to you right now. And if you want to stay here and pray and ask for God's healing now, today, we have members of our prayer team that will be with us after this service. And you don't have to get up. Just stay in your seats, and they will get to you. Now, depending on the number of people and the number of prayer team volunteers we have, it might take a while, so be patient with us. But if you want to stay and pray with someone for your healing, or someone that you love for their healing, I invite you to do that. For the rest of you, I think it's still a beautiful day out there, isn't it? Yes. Have a great weekend. Thank you very much.